Seamus, The Case of the Mason Jar, Part 15, The Mason Jars, is based on the book by John MacDonald, A Bullet for Cinderella.
I thought I heard him call, the sound mingling with the noise of the river. I followed Susie. She led the way down a curving path toward the south end of the island. The path dipped into a flat place. Rock walls were high on either side of us. It was a hollow where people had built fires.
It's so overgrown.
What are you looking for? She moved to one side and looked at the sloping wall. She nodded to herself and went up, nimble as a cat, using the tough vines to pull herself up. She stopped and spread the vines. She was above a ledge. She turned and motioned to me. My leather soles gave me trouble. I slipped and scrambled, but I made it to the ledge beside her. She pushed tough weeds and vines aside. She sat down and put her feet in the dark hole and wormed her way forward. When she was in up to her hips, she lay back and, using her hands on the upper edge of the small slit in the rocks, pulled herself in the rest of the way. I made hard work of it. It was narrow. She pulled at my ankles. Finally, I was inside. She leaned across me, her weight on me, and pulled the weeds and vines back to cover the hole. At first, I couldn't see. Then my eyes became used to the light. Daylight came weakly through the hole. The hole itself, the slit in the rocks, was not over 30 inches long and 14 inches wide at its widest point. Inside, it widened out to about 5 feet, and the ceiling was about 3 feet high. It was perhaps 7 feet deep.
Floyd found it. He was climbing on the rocks one day, and he found it. It was always dry and clean in here. See? The sand is dry. And feel how fine it is. It became our place. It became my favorite place in the whole world. I used to come here alone, too, when things got too hard. We used to keep things here. A box of candles and cigarettes and things. Nobody in the well could ever find us here. We kept blankets here and pillows. We called it our house. Kid stuff, I guess. It was nice. I never thought I'd come back here.
Then this is the place he meant.
Let's look.
It was easy to dig in the sand. She found the first one. She gave a little gasp of pleasure when she found it. She dug it out of the soft sand. We held it close to the weak light and opened it. The wire clamp slid off easily. The rubber ring was stuck to the glass. I pulled the top off. The bills were tightly packed. I pulled some of them out. We both dug in the place where she had found it. We lined the jars up along the side of the cave. I could see the money through the glass. I looked at the money. I remembered how I thought it would be. I had thought it would be an answer. Now it meant only that perhaps it could still be traded for a life.
No, he's coming this way.
I heard him when he called again.
James! Hunter James!
We lay prone, propped on our elbows, our heads near the small entrance, her cheek inches from mine.
Hunter James!
He was alarmingly close. He was passing just below us, his head about 6 or 7 feet below the ledge. He called again at a greater distance, and then all we could hear was the sound of the river.
What will we do?
All we can do is out waiting. We can't deal with him. He won't make deals. He's way beyond that. We'll have to wait until night. I don't think he'll leave. We'll have to try to get to the water at night. Can you swim? We'll have to take the money out of the mason jars and put it in the backpacks. May get wet in the river.
It'll dry.
We could make it to shore then with the money. We emptied the jars into the backpacks. There was no point in telling her the deal I had planned. There was no chance of making the deal. I was certain that if he found us, he'd kill both of us. When he had talked to me, I had sensed the pleasure he took in killing. The way he had talked of Leon, the way he talked about holding the knife at Irene's throat. That can happen to a man. There are men who hunt who do not take their greatest pleasure in the skill of the hunt, but rather in the moment of seeing the deer stumble and fall or a ragged bird come rocketing down. From animal to man is a difference in degree, not in kind. The lust to kill is in some men. It has sexual overtones. I had sensed that in Stucky. I could even sense it in the tone of his voice as he had called to me when he passed the cave. A warm sing-song tone. He knew we were on the island. He knew he would find us. He felt warm toward us because we could give him pleasure. Come on out and be killed, Hunter James. A welcoming and confident voice. It was not so much as though he had stepped beyond sanity, but as though he had stepped outside the race, had become another creature. It was the same way we all might be one day, hunted down by the alien creatures of some far-off planet. When that day comes, how do we bargain for life? What can the rabbit say to the barrel of a gun?
So we wait.
And we'll have to be very careful. He likes the night.
We will be careful. It's worth being careful. You know, Hunter, I thought all along this would get messed up. Now, I don't think so anymore. Isn't that strange? Now that it's as bad as it can get, I think we're gonna make it.
I hope so. She rolled onto her back. Her voice was soft.
We're gonna make it. We're going to get the car. There's enough money here. It isn't worth the risk of going back after my things. We'll drive through the night, Hunter. We'll drive all night. We'll take turns. I'm a good driver. I know just how it's going to be. We'll go to New Orleans. We can be there late tomorrow. I know a man there. He'll help us. We'll sell the car there. We'll catch our plane there. We'll have everything new. All new clothes. Mexico City first, I think. Then over to Havana. I was in Havana once with a friend. No, it wasn't Havana. Where will we go from there, Hunter?
Rio, Buenos Aires, then Paris.
Paris, of course. It's funny. I've always been looking. Like that game where you come into the room and they've named something, but you don't know what it is, and you have to find it. I've been looking for something I don't know the name of for a long time. You ever feel like that?
Yes.
You don't know what it is, but you want it. You look a lot of places for it. You try a lot of things, but they aren't it. This time, I know I'm going to find it.
I lay and looked out the entrance through the gaps in the vines and leaves. I could see the rock wall on the other side of the hollow, 30 feet away. By lowering my head and looking up, I could see the wedge of yellow sky above the rock. As I watched, I saw Stucky's head and then his shoulders above the rock wall. Behind me, Susie started to say something in a complaining voice. I reached back quickly and caught her arm and grasped it warningly. She stopped talking immediately. She moved forward and leaned her warm weight against the back of my left shoulder so that she too could see. It was instinctive to want to pull back into the cave, but I knew he could not see my face or hers behind the dense screen. He stood on the rock against the sky, feet spread, balancing easily. He held a gun in his hand. His big hand masked the gun, but it looked like a Luger. The strange sky made a dull glint on the barrel. When he moved his head, he moved it quickly as an animal does. His mouth was slack, his lips parted. His khaki pants were soaked to the knees. He studied the rock wall where the cave was, foot by foot. I flinched involuntarily when his gaze moved across the cave mouth. He turned and moved out of sight.
My God. My God, I can see what you mean. I'm glad I didn't have to chat with that. He's a damn monster. How come he's running around loose? Frankly, he scares the hell out of me. I tell you, they ought to shoot him on sight, like a crazy dog.
He's getting worse.
You can't get any worse than that. What was he looking over here for?
I think he's eliminating places where we could be, one by one. He's got a lot of daylight. I hope he eliminated this place.
You can't see much from over there. Just sort of a shadow. And the hole looks a little too even, even if it didn't have the stuff in front of it.
I hope you're right.
He gives me the creeps.
I kept a careful watch. The next time I saw him, he was climbing down the wall on the far side. Susie saw him, too. Her hand tightened on my shoulder. Her breath was warm against my ear.
What's he doing down there?
I think he's trying to track us. I don't know how good he is at it. If he's good, he'll find that our tracks end somewhere in the hollow.
The ground was so soft. By all that's holy, I hope he doesn't know how to track.
He was out of sight. We heard one rock clatter against another, audible above the roar of the river. We moved as far back in the little cave as we could get. Nothing happened for a long time. We gradually relaxed again and moved up to where we could watch. It must have been a full half hour later when I saw him on the far side, clambering up. He sat on the rim at the top. He aimed carefully somewhere off to our right and pulled the trigger. The sound was flat, torn away by the wind. He aimed and fired again, this time closer. I realized too late what he was doing. I tried to scramble back. He fired again. Blood burst from her face. The slug had furled down her face, smashed her teeth and her jaw, striking at an angle just under her cheekbone. She screamed again, the ruined mouth hanging open. I saw the next shot take her just above the left collarbone, angling down through her body. She dug her fingers into the sand, arched her body, then settled into death as the next bullet slapped damply into her flesh. I was pressed hard against the rocks at the side. He shot twice more into her body, then there was silence. I tried to compress myself into the smallest possible target. When he fired again, it was from a different angle. The slug hammered off rocks, ricocheting inside the small cave. Hitting two walls so quickly, the sound was almost simultaneous before it buried itself in the sand. The next one ricocheted, and from the sharp pain in my face, I thought it had hit me, but it had filled my right cheek with sharp rock fragments. I could move no further to the side. If he found the proper angle, he would hit me directly. If he did not, a ricochet could kill me. I grasped her body and pulled it over me. He fired several more shots. Another hit her body. My hands were sticky with her blood. I shielded my head against her heavy breast. My legs pulled up. I tried to adjust her body so it would give me maximum cover. A ricocheting slug wrapped the heel of my shoe with such force that it numbed my foot.
Ow!
I gave a harsh, loud cry of pain. The shooting stopped. After a few minutes, he spoke in an almost conversational tone. He was close under the cave.
Hunter! Hunter! Come on out of there!
I did not answer. He had thought of caves. He had fired into the shadowy places, had hit the right one. I hoped he would believe us both dead. It was my only chance. I wormed my way out from under her body. There were no loose stones in the cave. There were only empty jars. I took one jar and crouched off to the left of the entrance. I heard the rattle of rocks and knew he was climbing. I saw the vines tremble. I was poised, ready to hurl the jar at his face. But his face did not appear. His strong hand appeared, moving slowly into the cave, inviting me to grasp it. It was a clever move. I know that he is probably braced there, gun in the other hand, waiting for such a try. More of his arm came into the cave. I could see his shoulder blocking off the light, but I could not see his head. His brown hand crept across the sand and touched Susie's dark hair. Paused for a moment, felt its way to her face, touched lightly her dead eyes. She lay curled where I had pushed the body when I crawled out from under it. The hand moved across the sand again. It came to her flexed knee, touched the knee, felt the material of the pants, and in that moment I realized that he thought it was my knee. He had only seen her from the waist up when he had approached the island in the boat. She was curled in such a way that he could not relate the knee to the face that he had touched. His powerful fingers bit through the material, caught the flesh underneath, and twisted it cruelly. I heard his soft grunt of satisfaction. I readied myself. He put both arms in and wormed his way in head first. I knew he would not be able to see immediately. The gun was in his hand. As soon as his head appeared in the opening inside the vines, I smashed the glass jar full into his face. The jar smashed, cutting my hand. I tried to snatch the gun, but I was too slow. He was gone. I heard the loud thud as he fell. I knew that I could not afford to give him time to recover. I scraped myself badly as I slid through the entrance. I grasped the vines and stood up, teetering on the ledge. I saw him below me. He was on his hands and knees, gun still in his hand, shaking his head in a slow, heavy way. It was a 12-foot drop, perhaps a little more. I dropped onto him. I landed on the small of his back, heels together, legs stiff. My weight smashed him to the ground. The fall jolted me. I rolled to my feet with agonizing slowness and turned to face the expected shot. He lay quite still. The fingertips touched the gun. I picked it up and moved back away from him and watched him. By watching him closely, I could see the movement of his back as he breathed. I aimed at his head, but I couldn't make myself fire. Then I saw the breathing had stopped. I wondered if it was a trick. I picked up a stone and threw it at him. It hit his back and bounded away. Finally, I approached him and rolled him over, and I knew he was dead. He had fallen back off the narrow ledge, fallen with the broken pieces of heavy glass jar. Stunned, he had gotten to his hands and knees. He was trying to clear his head. When I had smashed him back to the ground, a large piece of the broken jar had been under his throat. As I watched him, his blood soaked the sandy soil. I went up to the cave again. I think I had the idea of carrying her down. I knew I couldn't make it. I looked at her. Paris was out. It was done. I looked at her and I wondered if this, after all, had been what she was looking for. It could have been. It could have been the nameless thing she sought. But I guess that had she been given her choice, she would have wanted it in a different form. Not so ugly. Not with ruined face and cheap clothes. I climbed up and down, retrieving the jars, and made my way to the river, filled each jar with water and threw it in the river. I left the money in the broken jar under Stucky. I made my way to the boat. I was exhausted. A few feet from the bottom, I slipped and fell. The police would come and find the bodies there when I told them where they were. I took the line and walked the boat down to the south end of the island. The current tugged at it. Below the island, the river was quieter. I got into the boat. Just as I started to row toward the shore, it began to rain. Rain that fell out of a yellow sky. The rain whispered on the gray river. It diluted the blood on my hands. The rain was on my face like tears. The banks were high. I found a place to beach the boat about 1,000 yards below the Haver place. I walked through wet grass to the road, and I walked to the car. I put the backpacks in the rear seat and stuffed Susie's clothes on top. I decided to call the police. My cell phone was smashed, wet, and dead. Heavy clouds had darkened the afternoon. I had never seen it rain as hard. Traffic crept through the charcoal streets of Lubbock, their lights yellow and feeble in the rain. I turned through the arch at the police station and parked beside the police cars. A man yelled at me from the doorway, telling me I couldn't park there. I paid no attention to him. I found Prasad. Captain Wayne wasn't in. He had gone home to sleep. Prasad stared at me in a funny way. He took my arm when he led me to a chair.
Are you drunk?
No, I'm not drunk.
What's the matter with you?
I know where to look for the girl, for Irene. North of town, near the river, if she's still alive. If she's dead, I don't know where to look. She wouldn't be far from where he got the boat.
What boat?
Are you going to look for her? Right now?
What boat, damn it?
I'll tell you the whole thing after you look. I want to come too. I want to come with you. They sent cars out. They called Captain Wayne and the chief of police. They sent people out to look in the rain. Scores of people searched. I rode with Prasad. In the end, it was a contingent of volunteers who found her. They found Stucky's car deep in some brambles and scrub oaks. The trunk compartment was open half an inch. We sped through the rain when word came over the radio, but the ambulance got there first. They were loading her onto the ambulance when we arrived. They closed the doors and drove away before I could see her. The car had been covered with a brown tarp. Some of the tarp had shifted in the wind, and one of the volunteers had seen the gleam of metal. Two policemen were there.
What shape was she in?
I don't think she'll make it. I think she was about gone. She looked about gone to me. You know, the way they all look. Just barely breathing. Color putty. Pretty banged up.
Prasad turned to me.
All right, we've got her now. How about Stucky? Start talking.
He's dead.
How do you know he's dead?
I killed him.
This has been Seamus, The Case of the Mason Jar, Part 15, The Mason Jars. It is based on the book by John MacDonald, A Bullet for Cinderella. Hunter James was played by Tom Hinton. Susie Haver was played by Marcia Taylor. Oren Stuckey was played by Nick Gordon. Sadiq Passad was played by Gordon Adams. The police officer was played by Thomas Thompson. I'm Leslie Woodruff. This episode of Seamus was written by Max Rees and directed by Tom Hinton. Seamus is a New Meadows Media production. All rights reserved.